The first hint that new players had arrived was that flare of light low in the polar night sky, partially hidden by the still intact wall opposite the ruins of the dockside gate. Most of the combatants paid it little attention, focused as they were on their opponents. Those who were native to the region noticed that it was in the direction of the southern spirit portal, but they too were more concerned on the particulars of their respective battles. What did get their attention was the rolling, howling roar that began to emanate from that direction, soft at first but gaining volume with every second. To those present who were of water tribe ancestry, the sound was intimately familiar, and a shiver of atavistic dread went down their spines. That sound could have only one source, a pack of polar bear dogs on the hunt. Despite their own avatar's taste in pets, every water tribesman and woman knew that a single wild polar bear dog was a fearsome predator, and the rare occasions when they came together to hunt in groups were times when no one would dare be out on the ice. At the sound, several of the turncoat white lotus and red monsoons who had the cultural background necessary dropped what they were doing and immediately turned to flee. This left them open to be taken down by the defenders in their panic, only adding to the chaos of the courtyard battle. But the rolling growls and howls of the approaching pack only got louder, until everybody in the compound had to take notice of it. Anakin Skywalker and Naza certainly did. In large part, this was because Neri, the third participant in the strange and violent dance they'd spent the battle locked in, suddenly looked up, her ears twitching. Naza thought to capitalize on this evident distraction on the part of his larger dance partner, feinting to lure Anakin slightly out of position and then lunging to strike the polar bear dog instead. Snarling, Neri raised one giant forepaw and cuffed him like a wayward pup, sending the armored warlord end over end into a column of ice left standing by some previous waterbending clash in this part of the battlefield. Then, the annoyance dispatched, she raised her nose to the sky and joined in the fast-approaching pack's cry, uttering a howl so loud and spine-chilling that it brought all combat in her immediate vicinity to a bewildered halt. "I guess that didn't work, huh?" Anakin replied conversationally as his opponent dragged himself back to his feet, shaking the cobwebs from his head for the 100th time.
"What do you suppose is wrong with the Avatar's pet?"
Naza wondered, trying for his usual mocking tone but only betraying his own genuine puzzlement. Anakin shrugged, his insouciant grin flashing on and off. "Probably got a whiff of your breath," he said, and then suddenly hurled himself back onto the offensive, every trace of mirth vanishing from his face. Whatever Naza intended to say in reply was cut off by the titanic crashing sound of the remaining intact wall of the compound being smashed inwards. Great blocks of ice and stone scattered like dice thrown by a giant, while smaller fragments flew like shrapnel, forcing people to dive for cover. Through the breach surged a veritable wave of polar bear dogs. No, polar bear dog spirits, their forms glowing and translucent in the auroral twilight. They tore into the remaining hostiles with all the ferocity of their mortal brethren, joined at once by a furiously jubilant Neri. And at the vanguard of the formation rode Avatar Korra, astride the spirit of Naga, her face wrathful, her eyes blue like ice. The remaining White Lotus turncoats gave up the fight at once, all the bravado which Chung's persuasive rhetoric had instilled within them evaporating at the sight of their avatar possessed of such terrible fury, and the knowledge that it was for them. It didn't escape their notice that, though rings of compressed air, icy water, searing fire, and jagged earth were all spinning around her, she wasn't even bothering with the avatar state to sustain them. Some fled in terror, some fell to their knees in surrender, but not a single one kept fighting. The Black Rose duelists didn't have the background to understand why that particular fact was so important, but a woman with such a powerful command of elemental magic, at the head of a wild hunt of ferocious, spectral apex predators, was daunting enough for most. With their local allies abandoning the fight, Administrator Kiryu nowhere to be seen, some were saying he was dead, and only one of the supposedly invincible armored warlords from Kaneko still in the fight, they began to lose the plot. Naza noticed the White Lotus traitors quitting the field as well, and, deeply tired of being battered about by this impudent but, he had to concede, very able child, he suspected they were in possession of a decent idea. This wasn't his fight. In his opinion, it had never been the Masho's fight, but Anubishu had been determined to use the Mad Demon Prince's scheme as a route to avenging Yamao, and, well, one didn't blow against the wind of Anubishu with a fixed idea if one knew what was good for one. With the senior warlord down and the White Rose duelist visibly taking command of the field, the Poison General's commitment to the affair had already been waning, and this new wrinkle blotted it out completely. That left only finding a way to disengage, but as he had the thought, he noticed one of the fallen figures on the battlefield stirring, then rising. And as it rose, Naza's serpent heart didn't know whether to rise with it or sink. Anubishu getting back into the battle could turn the tide back, but on the other hand, it meant his own escape route had just become quite a lot narrower. He had little desire to be here, but even less to receive the kind of thrashing the Darkness General would mete out to a colleague he caught retreating without orders. Still, he supposed he had better try to put the best face on it for his opponent. Maybe the failure of their so vaunted pink-haired leader to put Anubishu down for good would rattle the White Rose.
"Do you see, Skywalker?"
he taunted, keeping himself out of reach of the young samurai's greatsword.
"Lord Anubishu is back on his feet."
He indicated the pink-haired White Rose leader, some distance away. With her back to the place where she'd left Anubishu fallen in the snow, she hadn't noticed him rising again.
"His wrath will be limitless," Naza went on. "I almost pity that child."
The howls of the hunt and the crash of the falling wall dragged Anubishu back from unconsciousness and into a world of pain and fury. He used the one to feed the other, deliberately driving the stump of his right wrist into the icy ground as he got hold of his nodachi with his remaining hand, then used them both to push himself to his knees. The burst of fresh pain in his severed limb wiped away the last of the grogginess from having been knocked out and set his teeth on edge. Weakness leaving the body, his old fighting master had called pain, and it was a definition Anubishu himself had held to throughout his long and bloody career. He had to acknowledge that the cursed cold of this miserable place had done him one favor, in that it had frozen the wound and prevented him from bleeding to death while he lay unconscious. He felt a mild surge of approval for the duelist leader, in the midst of his growing hatred of her, at the realization that she had knocked him out and then left him for dead rather than wasting any of her side's medical resources on tending him. That was what he would have done. He hated her, would kill her, but had to admit, at the moment, that he respected Utena Tenjo for that. He dragged himself to his feet with the aid of his nodachi for support, his eyes narrowing to take in the deteriorating situation. The local forces in complete collapse, Otori's feeble children no better. Rajara down, either unconscious or dead, Anubishu cared nothing for which. Naza, still unable to finish off Sionji's boy child despite having had all the time in the world. Pathetic. Shuten nowhere to be seen. Unsurprising. He made a mental note to find the whelp when this was over and free Yamao's armor from his unworthy custody, a thing he now realized he should have done months ago. No matter. All of that was for later. Right now, and despite his complete indifference to Otori's actual cause, he had to turn this battle back around, and he was quite confident that he still could. Despite the winnowing of his forces, the power of his yoroi, channeled through his blade, would be enough to take care of the wayward spirits now tearing through the remaining Black Rose and Triad members with ghostly fang and claw, Then he would make an example of their mistress, which should take the fight out of anyone native to this miserable dung heap of a world. Following that, the duelists of the White Rose would be alone. Anubishu allowed himself a cruel, bloody smile. Foolish children. He admired Tenjo's ruthlessness in leaving him for dead, but upon reflection it was a schoolgirl mistake. She should have known better than to leave him alive at all. Far better to finish him where he lay than take the risk of him recovering. Upon reflection, he decided to start with her, teach her the folly of that error as a final lesson upon which to reflect in eternity, and then seek out the Avatar. Even with only one hand, his grip on the haft of his weapon was sure, and he began to move forward, the shadow energy once again coalescing around the blade. Before he could even take a couple of steps forward, the Avatar had sought out him. With a suddenness that caught the fixated Masho leader completely by surprise, her spectral mount loomed up out of the battle-blown snow. Uttering a wordless cry, the phantom beast's rider sprang from its back and descended upon Anubishu like a diving hawk. He barely managed to blurt out a startled, "What?" before Korra slammed into his armor, driving him backward by the sheer force of her body, his Nodachi flung away by one of the winds surrounding her. Apart from her opening battle cry, she offered no challenge, just grim determination and the fury of the Avatar as her hand went straight for his armored neck. Although the Yoroi prevented her from crushing his larynx and throat in her steely grip, it did nothing to prevent him from being forced to the ground by the Avatar's arm, nor did it keep him from being dragged across the courtyard head first on his back. He crashed across the ground, leaving a furrow of broken ice in his wake, as she surfed a wave of frost and rock beside him, her momentum from her initial charge unbroken.
"You dare attack my family in my own home?" Korra declared, her voice, like the fury that fueled it, solely her own.
In reply, Anubishu could only offer a groaning scream of pain before his entire viewpoint was turned end over end, as Avatar Korra then proceeded to fling him over the heads of the remaining people toward the high-walled keep in the distant rear of the battleground. His last thought before impact was that it was fortunate that he was going to miss the windows. He doubted he could live with himself if he'd gone through one of them. And then his already punished body learned that while the Yoroi was technically unbreakable, rose princes and ancient god swords notwithstanding, it did nothing to protect the body inside from blunt force trauma. At that point, his mind mercifully shut down once more, even as his body fell from the crater that had been impressed on the outer fortress wall. "Or not," said Anakin with a teeth-gritted parody of good cheer, and he walloped Naza so hard in the chest plate that the impact separated the warlord from his weapons, again, and sent him smashing clean through the nearest of the Seracs, again. Actually hissing with fury and frustration, Naza scrambled to his feet and looked for another angle, and, with the kind of sublime good fortune that had eluded him and his colleagues for most of the day, he found one. The desperate scowl behind his menpo changed to a sly smile as he reached out an arm and seized the nearest combatant by the neck, dragging her into a headlock and presenting the edge of his holdout dagger to her throat.
"Let's find out how soft you are, boy," he said. "This initiate should pose no particular obstacle to prowess such as yours, unless, of course, you can't bear to see her get hurt."
Anakin blinked, his surprise momentarily washing the fury from his face, as the Black Rose duelist the warlord had taken hostage made eye contact with him, and he realized she wasn't part of the anonymous mass, at least, not to him. "Lena," he said, "what are you doing here? You're one of Mikage's students, not Tremaine's." Even as he asked the question, Anakin knew it was a stupid one, because the answer was obvious. While Lena Tarrant wasn't one of the Sith Lord's students, and so wouldn't have been automatically included in the body of initiates assigned to do Kiryu's bidding in this matter, She hated the chief of the international police. Father, by blood or adoption, of no fewer than three of the White Rose's leaders, with a passion that rivaled his own hatred of slavers and kidnappers. Of course she would have volunteered for this assignment. For her part, Lena knew he'd realize the pointlessness of the query as soon as he uttered it and didn't bother responding to it. Instead, what she said, to both Anakin's and Naza's surprise, was, "Do it, Skywalker."
"My, my," Naza remarked. "That was unequivocal. What say you, boy? Keep in mind, if you do as you're told, she will die, even if your own onslaught doesn't kill her."
He adjusted the position of his blade slightly.
"I will."
Anakin hesitated, the inner conflict evident on his face. Seeing it, Lena snarled,
"Never mind me. Kill him!"
The young samurai looked into his friend's dark, angry, weirdly unafraid eyes for a long moment. And then, looking away, he shut off his lightsaber and replaced it on his belt with his left hand, while with his right he drove the point of his greatsword into the ground, leaving it standing upright between them.
"No! What are you doing?"
Lena began, but Naza cut her off by tightening his grip a little and taking a half step back.
"Just as I thought," the warlord said, "soft-hearted and soft-headed, just like..."
Naza stopped speaking, not because he wanted to, but because he had to. Despite the impenetrable gorget of his enchanted armor, a sensation like that of a powerful hand clamping violently onto the front of his neck suddenly seized him, choking off the taunt and bringing him up on tiptoes. It felt uncannily like the crushing grip Skywalker's stone paw had inflicted on his hand at the beginning of the battle, but the boy hadn't moved. He was just standing there, his face like an iron mask, blue eyes full of wrath boring into Naza's face. The warlord's own reptilian eyes bugged out as he tried and failed to draw breath. Likewise, he was unable to force his right hand to make even the small motion that would have been necessary to slit the initiate girl's throat. In fact, he felt both of his hands being prized away from her, as if by iron pry bars, until the knife fell from his hand and she was able to slip free. Silent and implacable, Anakin raised the hand of wrath from his side and held it up between them, palm upraised, fingers curled into a claw-like posture. Naza felt himself lifted clean off the ground, his boots dangling, as his world began to go red from the edges.
"I find your lack of faith disturbing," Anakin told him, his voice as flat and cold as his face.
And then, with a sudden explosive motion, he flung his stone hand straight out to the side, arm pointing toward the far horizon, and Naza was hurled in that direction like a missile. The throw was not quite as impressive as Korra's of Anabishu, but Naza would have hit the compound's outer wall if it had still been there. And since it was not, he didn't stop until he hit the fjord, crashing through the thin ice that had formed over the place where I-401 had been, and vanishing into the water below with a towering splash.
"Wow," said Lena, after collecting her thoughts for a moment. "Thanks, Sky... what?"
"Don't even speak to me," Anakin said coldly. And then, wrenching his greatsword out of the ground, he turned on his heel and strode off toward the dying embers of the greater battle.
It was basically over by that point. The Black Rose offensive had been crumbling anyway when the last of the outer walls had come down. Korra's arrival and her summary dismissal of Anabishu broke its back altogether. The remaining White Lotus turncoats had already fled or surrendered, and the Black Rose duelists who were still on their feet lost all cohesion with the Darkness General's final defeat. What had already been looking like a successful defense transmuted into a rout.
"Utena!" Wakaba cried, running across the devastated battlefield in the aftermath.
"Are you okay?"
"I'm fine. Don't worry about me," Utina replied. Are you all right? What the heck just happened? She paused, realizing for the first time that her friend was sporting RCPD tactical armor over battered street clothes, carrying a sword of unknown provenance, and, most surprising of all, wearing a Future Industries lightning glove on her left hand. And what's with the gear? Had a little Captain Caveman problem. That's not important right now, Wakaba said with a never-mind-that gesture of her gauntleted hand. Where's Anthy? I managed to convince her to hole up inside when they breached the wall, Utina said, gesturing vaguely to the jagged hole where the boat dock postern had been. Come on, I want to check on Corwin, and then we'd better go let her know it's all over. On the way to the makeshift casualty shelter, they regrouped with Kate and Maki. Cora was already there, crouching next to Corwin's still unconscious form, while Neri exchanged subdued Urso-canine greetings with her ancestors off to one side. Pushing their way through the impromptu cordon of loyal guards and Water Tribe reinforcements, a pair of unexpected figures intercepted the three duelists and one Kyoshi warrior in some haste. One of them was a tall, slim, grim-faced youth in his late teens or early 20s, dressed in what Utina supposed Jedi robes would look like if you made them mostly out of dark brown leather. He had a greatsword slung across his back, a lightsaber hanging from his belt, and his right forearm and hand seemed to be made of stone. She didn't recognize him, but she certainly recognized the somewhat older man next to him, even in spite of his unfamiliar clothing and the startling shortness of his green hair. Sionji, Utina blurted. What in the... There's no time, Sionji replied, his eyes fixing hers with something like an echo of his intensity from unhappier times, but no hostility. This isn't over. Kate, Utina, and Wakaba shared a quick three-way glance, all reached the same conclusion, and then ran for the keep. Cora looked up from assessing Corwin's condition, out cold but evidently uninjured, saw them running, and rose, puzzlement on her face. Watch him, she said to the loyal White Lotus medic who'd come to take charge of the casualties. Then, without looking the battered and restrained Chong in the face, she added in a clipped tone to the Water Tribe Navy sailor who was doing the restraining, Bring him. He has some questions to answer once I find out what's going on. Inside the keep, everything seemed normal at first. The enemy forces had never penetrated the main building, so its main corridor and great hall were undisturbed. The White Lotus traders Utina and the others had fought to get out of the trap in the front room were still right where they'd left them, but everything else was in order. As he followed Utina down the hallway to the storeroom, Sionji let himself hope that maybe, just maybe, either his intel was in error or Otori's contingency plan simply hadn't worked. That hope lasted until Utina yanked open the storeroom door, and they all saw what lay beyond. The room was a shambles to rival anything outside. At a glance, it looked as though everything that could possibly have been overturned, spilled, smashed, or scattered had been. There was a distinct floral scent in the air. Wisteria, Utina realized, apropos of nothing. And, weirdly, petals of the same were strewn about the room. Nima lay crumpled against the wall near the door, motionless. On the far side, another, unfamiliar figure was slumped in a similar position, below a starburst of cracks in the wall that spoke of arriving there with considerable violence. In the middle of the room, in a roughly circular area that looked as if it had been cleared by an explosion, Anthy lay face down on the floor, her hand outstretched as if reaching for the stranger. No. Sionji fell to his knees in grief and failure, a puppet with cut strings, and moaned, We're too late. Cora, her prisoner, and her self-appointed escorts arrived moments later to find confusion, consternation, and shock. Kate looked up from easing Nima gently into the recovery position, and Cora was shocked at the drawn pallor of her face. She hadn't looked like that out in the courtyard, even in the aftermath of an obvious fight for her life.
A moment later, the Avatar knew the reason why, as Caitlin said in a low, dread-filled voice, "Annabelle and Garnet, they're gone." Kneeling at Anthea's side, her mind briefly so overwhelmed that she hadn't even figured out what she was feeling yet, Utena noticed something white peeking out from beneath Anthea's outstretched hand. Gently extracting it, she saw that it was a folded sheet of paper, which, when unfolded, proved to be a letter, one written in an instantly, spine-chillingly familiar hand. So engrossed was she in the text of this letter, reading it with eyes going slowly wider in an increasingly colorless face, that Utena took a moment to register the sound of a commotion behind her. When at last she did, she turned her head and saw Chiang running down the hall, having taken advantage of the shock and confusion among his captors to overpower the one nearest to him and make a break for it. Around her, the others all registered the Master Lotus's escape attempt, too, and many of them prepared to intervene. But before any of them could take action, Utena had bolted to her feet, stuffed the letter into her coat, and lit out after him. Chiang was going flat out himself, and though several decades her senior, he was a fast runner, particularly with the motivation he currently had to propel him. He knew the keep better than she did as well, and could take the most efficient path to his goal, pausing only long enough to throw various obstacles in her path. Calling on what felt like long-ago experiences of school athletics, Utena dodged, hurdled, or battered her way through his attempts to forestall her, until at last, near the front of the keep, he managed to slam and bolt a door in her path. He emerged from the keep still in the lead, putting everything he had left into a headlong dash for one of the motor skis standing off to one side. Utena dropped from the sky above him, having sprinted up a set of stairs and then thrown herself unhesitatingly from one of the second-level battlements, and hit him like the proverbial hundredweight of bricks. Borne down by her weight, still moving forward at something like his top speed, they both hit the ground hard and tumbled, disappearing from Chong's other pursuer's view in a cloud of snow. When it settled a moment later, Chiang was sprawled flat on his back with Utena crouched upon his chest. With her left hand, she held his right arm pinned to the ground. Her right forearm was pressed across his throat as she glared down into his face.
"Tell me something, Chiang," she snarled through gritted teeth.
"Huh? What?"
the Master Lotus rasped, his eyes wide with alarm. Utena leaned a little farther down, her furious azure glare boring into his soul, and hissed,
"Tell me there's some way I won't kill you."
If he had an answer for that, it wasn't forthcoming, for a moment later, he passed out. Utena remained where she was for a moment longer. Then, her expression changing slowly from fury to disgust, she straightened, then climbed to her feet and stood over his unconscious form for a few moments, breathing hard. Behind her, several of the White Lotus loyalists hovered a short distance away, uncertain whether approaching would help or do more harm. Abruptly, she whirled, turning her back on Chiang, and as she stalked past them and back toward the keep, she growled to one of them, "Get him out of here before I change my mind again." An hour later, some semblance of order had been restored, at least to the innermost part of Fort Tonrock. Among the reinforcements arriving from Nanisevic was Bori, still sporting his NTC medic's armband. He hadn't had a lot of sleep since the festival, given the high demands the riot had placed on the city's medical infrastructure, but when the call came in for volunteers to help handle the situation at Fort Tonrock, well, no self-respecting son of Senna could have ignored that. A bruised and fretful-looking fellow waterbender directed him to a bedroom deep in the interior of the keep. There, he found Cora standing over the bed in the middle of the room, on which was stretched out one of her friends from outside, Anthy Tenjo. Though she had no overtly visible injuries, Anthe seemed to be unconscious, and Korra was evidently trying to revive her with waterbending healing. But the agitated Avatar was visibly struggling to achieve the necessary composure. Entering the room, Bori went to her side, put a gentle hand on her shoulder, and said quietly, "Perhaps you'd best leave this to me, Korra." She glanced at him in surprise, then nodded and moved aside, returning the water she'd been using to a bedside basin. Bori took a moment to consider the patient's condition, then took up the water himself and set to work. "She's in good hands," Korra said quietly to Utrina, Corwin, and Caitlin as she joined them, though none of them had asked. "I know he's young, but Bori's fully qualified. He's Nanuruk's son and a graduate of Nanisevik Yu's medical school. They don't give out their MDs for perfect attendance." Her face drawn, Utrina could only nod. Korra took her free hand and squeezed it gently, then looked past her at Corwin. After he'd recovered enough for Utrina to break the news of what had happened to him, he'd barely spoken to anyone, even her. Now his profile looked as if it had been carved from stone, his one visible eye like a chip of ice. Bori worked, quickly but methodically, for 10 minutes, then returned the water to the bowl and turned to them with a slight smile. "I have good news," he said. "Her injuries weren't terribly severe. Her collapse was mostly due to shock. She's sleeping now, and I expect she will for the next 12 to 15 hours. But when she wakes, she should be fine."
"Thank you,"
said Corwin, his voice hoarse.
"You're welcome, Corwin," said Bori with a nod. "Caitlin, do you need any more help with your arm?" he asked, indicating the makeshift sling Kate wore.
"No, thank you, Bori," she said. "It's set properly. I'll be all right in a day or two."
"In that case, I'll go and see to the others," said Bori. He shook his head sadly.
"Such a terrible thing. I'm so sorry."
"Not your fault," Corwin told him, almost inaudibly.
"Can I stay with her?" Utrina asked as he turned to go.
"By all means," he said. "You won't disturb her, and I'm sure she'll appreciate having you nearby when she wakes."
Corwin positioned a chair at Anthe's bedside for Utrina, then stood as if in a fit of indecision for a few moments. Utrina sat down, then looked up, head tilted to give him a curious look.
"Corwin?" she asked.
He didn't reply, just stood by the bedside for a few seconds, regarding Anthe's sleeping face, his own completely unreadable. Then, mumbling something inarticulately apologetic, he turned and all but rushed from the room.
"Corwin?"
Utrina repeated, rising to pursue him, but before she could get all the way to her feet, Korra forestalled her with a hand on her shoulder.
"Stay with Anthe," she said gently. "I've got this."
Utrina looked her in the eye for a moment, her expression torn between worry and her own pain. Then she nodded, saying nothing, and returned to her seat as the Avatar strode briskly out. In another part of the compound, Maki knelt on the floor, indifferent to the cold, the dim, and the silence. She felt the discomfort, of course, the chill of the air, the hardness of the stone floor, the dull aches of her battered body, and the sharper, more insistent pain of her injured leg. But she ignored it. She was too preoccupied with the mental and emotional pain for the mere physical kind to reach her consciousness. Stretched out on a low table in the center of the room, neatly attired in her most archaic and formal armor, lay Izumi. In a few hours, an honor guard would arrive to bear her home to Kyoshi Island and a hero's funeral. Tonight, it fell to Maki, as the only other Kyoshi warrior present, to sit the traditional low lamplight vigil over her fallen comrade's body. Weary or not, wounded or not, she was the only one who could carry out this task, provide this ancient honor. She had been sitting in silent Cezah for some time. She wasn't keeping track, it might have been hours, when Maki, her voice a low murmur, suddenly spoke.
"I don't understand, Izumi. Why? Why didn't you run? The way you fought, it was like you already knew you would die today."
"She did," said a calm voice from behind her. Maki was halfway to her feet, her tessen half drawn, before she finished turning and realized who the speaker was. Then she fell back to her knees, the weapons falling from her hands, and stared in blank astonishment.
"Avatar Kyoshi," she breathed. "But how can you be here? Korra..."
She trailed off. The tall, formally robed figure of her home island's namesake avatar shook her head, her painted face solemn. "No," she said. "Korra is far from here, tending to her own business. She has her own life, her uncle's unintended gift on the occasion of harmonic convergence," Kyoshi said, and then, at Maki's puzzled expression, she went on, "Never mind that. I think you know this is not the first time you and I have met today."
Yes,
said Maki, slowly getting hold of herself.
I can't remember it clearly, but it must have been you, mustn't it?
Kyoshi came nearer, then settled herself to the floor, mirroring Maki's position an arm's length away. "Yes," she said. "When the spirit of one of my descendants screams out so loudly, so passionately for justice, that is not a call I would ever ignore." Maki gazed into her ancestor's face in silence for a long moment, her thoughts jumbling atop each other. Then she bowed her head, sighing, and said,
"Thank you. I only wish it had been worth it."
Kyoshi arched an eyebrow. "What do you mean?"
Corwin told me about what the thing that killed Izumi was, how it won't stay dead."
She shook her head, adding bitterly, "So not only did I fail to protect my little sister, I couldn't even properly avenge her." Kyoshi startled her by laughing. A dark, cold laugh, to be sure, but a laugh all the same. Maki raised her head, outrage flashing in her eyes, but any objection she might have been about to lodge died on her lips as her eyes met the past avatars, and she saw the complete and utter lack of humor there.
"I wouldn't say that," said Kyoshi.
Togakiryu stirred, then set about slowly, painfully pulling himself back together. He had never really gotten used to the experience of having his shell slain like that. A petty setback it might be in the grand new scheme of things, but it still hurt, and it was a hassle. Now he would have to put up with his sister's taunts again, endure the mocking whispers of the underclassmen, and deal with Akio's cool sarcasm as he explained how he had once again managed to come a cropper in the course of executing one of the Black Prince's schemes. Groaning with as much dread of all that as with the pain, he opened his eyes and realized that he wasn't where he should be. He should be lying on the stone floor of the chamber at the top of the Black Tower, in the exact center of the Otori Institute's geomantically precise campus, where Akio had relocated the sigil stone from its original lodgings in Sheol at the start of the Orifus project. That selfsame item should now be hovering above him, seething red and black, its infernal grip on his demonic soul having wrested it back from wherever it was when his shell was destroyed. Instead, he seemed to be outdoors. Somewhere. The ground beneath him was frigid, either earth or very hard-packed snow, and he was surrounded by an icy mist that seemed to have an almost physical substance as it swirled and curtained around him. The sky overhead was black, but ribbons of color flickered in it, muted and diffused by the mist.
"What the?"
Togo mumbled, dragging himself to his feet. Looking around, he saw nothing by which he might get his bearings, just this same trackless mist engulfing everything within a few yards.
"All right, don't panic, Kiryu," he told himself. Mikage thought this might happen. Something to do with the weird cosmology of wherever it was Tenjo and her pets thought they could hide from us. You'll just have to use the recall.
A figure loomed up before him, tendrils of mist parting around it as if driven by a sudden wind. Togo blinked at the sight thus revealed. A woman, her face painted up like the faces of those two girls he had just been fighting, the one he'd killed, and the one who had evidently killed him. This was neither of them, he could tell that right away. This was no teenager, but a grown woman. Very tall and dressed in an elaborate, old-fashioned fighting kimono in gold-trimmed green. After a moment's puzzlement, Toga realized she was the ghostly figure he'd seen superimposed on the second one when she made what turned out to be her final attack. In her right hand, she held... he wasn't really sure what. It looked like a katana, or at least the shape of a katana, but it seemed to be made of light, not metal, its outline hazy, half-formed, insubstantial. If swords had ghosts, he supposed, that's what one would look like. Recognizing, for once, a situation he was ill-equipped to handle, Toga opened his mouth to utter the word of recall which the Castellan had taught him. But before he could do so, the woman in green had fixed him with furious eyes and snapped in a sharp, commanding voice, "Be silent, monster. There is nothing you can say that will avail you here." Such was her force of personality that Toga actually found himself hesitating. And then, when he recalled himself to his purpose and tried to speak the word, he found to his horror that no sound emerged. The green-clad woman spared a tiny, icily sardonic smile for that, and then dismissed him with her eyes and turned her attention to the phantom blade she held in her hand. "Here is the soul of one such as you were forged to slay," she said, her voice resonant with a fury beyond ordinary comprehension, as she took the spectral weapon in both hands. His eyes going wide with sudden terror, Toga tried to run, but stumbled as the ground itself in this place betrayed him. He sprawled headlong, scrambling, trying to crawl, anything. Sheer mortal fear overwhelming him for the first time since he had found himself risen in Muspelheim. "Taste it!" the woman cried, lunging after him, and the spirit sword in her hands bit deep into Toga's back, its blade plunging into him as if into a quenching trough. Still he could make no sound, none at all, as the supposedly immortal essence of all he was boiled like water at the touch of hot steel. "Hone your edge upon it," Avatar Kyoshi intoned, "that you may know its like again, that you may slay its kin you find, forever after." Kyoshi stood amid the clearing mists and regarded the sword in her hands. As the last of Toga Kiryu's soul boiled away to nothing, the blade's perfect zigzag hamon shimmered in the green-blue glow of the southern lights. Then, composing herself, she sheathed the sword and faced the sea of ghosts, bowing in the direction her fallen descendant's departing spirit would have taken, toward the far distant, unseen shore of Asgard. "Go in peace, Izumi," the Avatar thought. "I have done all that I can to give you justice." Maki stared at Kyoshi, dumbstruck, for what might have been hours, but was probably only a few seconds, before finally finding her voice.
Then that means...
Kyoshi inclined her head. You may tell the visitors that at least one of their foes is no more, she said. It will not bring them happiness, but it may afford them some satisfaction.
I will, said Maki, nodding.
She rose slowly to her feet and turned to regard her fallen sister's face. After a few moments, she asked without looking up,
Why did you say Izumi knew that she would die today?
Because she did, Kyoshi replied simply, moving to her side. Izumi's connection to the spirit world was strong. Strong enough, in some moments, for her to get glimpses of what was to come. She knew when that battle began that it would be her last.
Then that's why she fought the way she did, said Maki softly,
placing a hand on Izumi's cool cheek.
As if she had nothing to lose.
Kyoshi nodded.
Exactly. She was... The dragons call it Virdanik, dying doomed. Dragon lore holds that to know that one is Virdanik is a great honor, because it enables one to make one's last acts count for all they possibly can.
She certainly did that, Maki murmured.
Yes, Kyoshi agreed. She did.
The two stood together in silence for a while longer. Then Kyoshi turned to Maki and said,
I must go. Before I do, I have this for you.
So saying, she presented the younger warrior with a new sword, the very one, Maki realized as soon as she touched it, that the Avatar had just described.
This is Otome Shiho, Kyoshi told her.
Maiden's Justice. Forged from your righteous fury and quenched with the soul of a monster. Folding her descendant's fingers around the katana's grip, she went on. As long as you live, she shall serve no hand but yours. Maki took a firmer grip on the sword and bared a few inches of its blade, enough to see its shining, perfect temper line in the light of the one low lamp. Her eyes shone, too, as she looked up from it. Kyoshi was gone. Shaken but resolute, Maki returned Otome Shiho fully to its sheath, slipped it through the obi of her formal uniform, and sank back into Seiza to await the nominal morning. Corwin didn't park his borrowed motor ski so much as abandon it. At this hour, Senna was sleeping peacefully. Evidently no word had reached the village yet about the disturbance over on the outskirts of Kurluktuk. He had no desire to be the one to tell them about it, so rather than risk waking anyone, he shut off the vehicle's motor and left it atop the ridge overlooking the town, then walked down the slope and let himself into Cora's house in silence. Once inside, he didn't turn on a light or start a fire, though the living room was both dark and rather chilly. The house, like most homes in the Southern Water Tribe, had long since been retrofitted with central heating, but with Korra away from home, it was only set high enough to keep the plumbing from freezing. Corwin didn't care about that, either. He pulled off his boots and outer clothes in the dark, hung parka and snow trousers on the pegs by the door out of sheer mechanical habit, and made his way into the bedroom by memory alone. Once there, he sat on the edge of the bed and, again out of nothing but mindless habit, opened up the mail client of his Omni-tool. The last message he'd replied to was still at the top of his inbox, with his confident little reply containing the sentence, "We're okay." He'd composed most of a long, rambling amendment to that assertion before he realized what an idiotic thing he was doing, canceled the message, and shut the tool off. The annoyance he felt with himself over the email he'd almost sent broke him out of the robotic fugue he'd slipped into on the ride over. Now he crawled under the heavy furs, curled up on his side and lay there shivering, for reasons that had nothing to do with the temperature of the room outside the covers. He didn't know or care how long he'd been there, though he didn't think it had been long, before he heard first the front door, then the bedroom door, open and close again. "Hello, Cora," he said quietly, without looking. "How did you know it was me?" Cora's hushed voice asked. He felt her weight press down the side of the bed behind him as she sat on the edge of it. "It's your house," Corwin replied bleakly. After a short pause, Cora said softly, "Fair point." Then, after another brief silence, she went on, "I'm not going to ask if you're all right. That would be stupid. But why come here? Utin is worried about you. Everybody's worried about you." The mattress jounced slightly as she climbed the rest of the way onto the bed and lay down alongside him, putting a hand on his shoulder. "I'm worried about you," she added in a still lower voice. "I can't," Corwin said, then stopped, his voice failing. In a choked whisper, the sound barely passing through his pain-tightened throat, he went on, "I can't face them. After this, I have no right to turn..." He broke off, unable to make any more sounds come out, and just lay there, his whole body racked with silent grief. Cora didn't remonstrate with him or try to reason with him, didn't point out that Utna doubtless felt exactly the same way, didn't tell him that both the Tenjos were going to need him when Anthe awoke. She knew that, in the place where he was at this moment, none of it would reach him. Knew what he needed now wasn't logic or fact or even truth, because all of those things were on higher levels than his being was capable of operating at right now. Instead, she burrowed under the covers with him and enfolded him in her arms from behind, drawing him close, like she had in this very bed, she suddenly remembered, when he was a little boy with a shivering fever. She didn't say, "It's okay," either, because it manifestly wasn't, and it wasn't in Cora's nature to lie to people she loved, even socially. Instead, she told him the only thing that was manifestly real and relevant right now. "I'm here with you. Whatever you need, I'm here." Corwin lay still for a few moments, taking deep, shuddering breaths, as if considering what he did need. Then, taking hold of her arm where it crossed his chest, he drew her tighter still to him and whispered, "Tell me." He paused, gathering his strength, and then forced the sentence out. "Tell me this isn't my fault." "Oh, Corwin. If it's anyone's fault, it's mine," Cora thought, but she didn't say that aloud either. Instead, she murmured, "Of course it's not." And though she was reasonably sure he didn't believe her, she didn't feel she was lying, and he didn't challenge the point. In fact, he said nothing more at all that night, just lay there, holding onto her arm like a drowning man, and shivered with silent sobs until he drifted off to sleep. "I'm here," Cora told him one last time, and she went to sleep herself. The keep at Fort Tonrock had fallen entirely quiet by midnight. Apart from the Southern Water Tribe militia personnel on guard, most of the people remaining within were asleep. Utna Tenjo was not. Sitting by Anthe's bedside, she had just finished rereading the letter she'd found by her wife's hand for the 2 or 3 dozenth time. Finally, with a sound that was half snarl and half sob, she folded it up and thrust it into her shirt pocket, buttoning the flap over it as if locking away a prisoner. With a great sigh, she slumped in her chair, gazing silently at her sleeping wife's face. She was aware that she was tired. Exhausted, in fact. But it was not the kind of exhaustion that tended toward sleep. Quite the opposite, in fact. It was rather the kind of exhaustion that leads the mind around in circles, trying in vain to find some other way for the day's events to have come out. Struggling to work out whether some of the questions raised even had answers. At this moment, Utna wasn't sure of that. She wasn't sure of much. The only thing she knew for certain was that she had failed. By no coincidence, the same thought was preoccupying the mind of the man who sat Cezar just outside the door. The militiamen and the handful of White Lotus loyalists who remained on their feet hadn't known quite what to make of him, with his curious high-tech weapon and his equally curious intensity. But the Avatar's friends had vouched for him, and under the circumstances that was enough. They left him alone. Which was just as well, since Kyuichi Sayanji didn't consider himself fit company for anyone at the moment. He heard footsteps approaching in the hallway and opened his eyes, his body going slightly tense, even though he doubted there would be a second strike. Hattori had what he'd set out to get this time. A moment later he realized, through the Force or Zanshin or both, who was approaching, and though his tension did not dissipate, the reason for it changed. A moment later, Caitlin and Wakaba arrived to find him sitting outside the door. Neither had had a chance to speak with him between the end of the battle outside and the terrible discovery within, and though both had plenty to speak with him about, neither felt any particular inclination to do it now. Instead, Caitlin asked him in a hushed, outside-the-sick-room voice, "What are you doing out here?" "The only thing I can," Sayanji replied. Kate mulled that over for a moment, holding her gaze on her wayward student's eyes. Then, evidently satisfied, she nodded, saying nothing. "Where's your buddy?" wondered Wakaba. "The kid with the stone hand." "I don't know," Sayanji answered. "Anakin is adept at knowing when space is required." "Ah," Wakaba said. "Well, I'm sure there's a story there, but this isn't the time. It isn't the time for a lot of things." "Agreed," said Sayanji with a nod. "For right now?" "I'm glad you're alive," she went on. And then, briefly tagging his shoulder with her fingertips, she passed him and went into the room with Kate. "You handled that very maturely," Kate murmured dryly once the door closed behind them. "Thank you," Wakaba replied. "Of course," she added after a moment's pause, "he's still completely dumped." "Of course," Kate agreed, and then they pulled up chairs on either side of Utna. "How are you holding up?" Wakaba inquired softly. Utna's only reply at first was a wordless, non-committal noise. Then, bowing her head and closing her eyes, she admitted in a voice not far short of a whimper, "Not great, if I'm honest." Wakaba put her arm around her best friend's shoulders and held her tight. "And you're always honest," she rejoined, knocking her head gently against Utrina's. "Don't try to get me to laugh," Utrina told her. "I'm not." "Because there's no way I can right now." "I know." The three sat in silence for more than a minute, both Wakaba and Kate with an arm around Utrina, just being close to her. Then, out of nowhere, the Rose Prince murmured, "I don't know what to do. I just don't. I haven't felt like this in years. Maybe not since the old days." At that, Wakaba made a quiet sound and drew her closer still.
I feel like I should be doing something, taking action, except there's nothing for me to do. Korra's people are out looking for the ones that got away, but it won't really matter if they catch them. I can't...
She shook her head and repeated,
I don't know what to do.
I know, Wakaba said again, but that'll change. On Usuna's other side, Kate nodded.
They want us to feel like this is the end of the game, and we've lost.
It isn't. We haven't.
Damn right it isn't,
Wakaba agreed, her voice still soft but full of resolve.
Uchna, I know you're stunned right now. You feel passive, reactive, like you're out of ideas. It's a horrible feeling. I've been there. I know. But trust me, it's not going to last. We've been here, you and me. The circumstances are different, but we've been down here before. We came through it. We ride it out for now, and when we're through...
She paused, then put her free hand on Uchna's near shoulder, squeezing gently.
We'll be ready for whatever we find.
Yeah, sure,
Uchna said, and though both Wakaba and Kate both knew she was only agreeing to humor them, they both decided it would be enough for now. Airy Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, A Duelist Opera, Fifth Movement, Taken by Storm. Written by Benjamin D. Hutchins, Anne Cross, Jeff DePew, Philip Jeremy Moyer, and Matt Wagner, with the gracious aid of EPU's usual suspects. Anubishu lay on the narrow bunk of his heavily reinforced cell and contemplated his fate. He wasn't so much angry just now as incredulous, still unable to believe quite how badly the operation had gone wrong. Kiryu's death didn't bother him, nor did Roger's, really. But for all four of the Masho to have been defeated in a single battle, one killed, one captured, and two forced to flee like cowards and barely succeeding in that, it was simply beyond his ability to grasp all at once, particularly the fact that he was the one who had been captured, and not, for instance, that whelp Shuten. They wouldn't hold him, of course, raise as many earthen prisons as they liked, bury his yoroi as deep as they wished, these primitives couldn't keep Anubishu, demon general of darkness, prisoner for long. His will was too powerful. Apart from the Avatar, no native of this world he had so far seen had the inner steel required to best him, and there was no way she would be his jailer. Without warning, a rectangular section of one of the stone walls fell away into the floor, revealing a corridor of smooth rock that stretched away into some dark distance. A slim, black-haired young woman in what looked, in the dim light, like it might be some sort of police uniform, entered. Anubishu sat up on his bunk and turned to face her, his expression a contemptuous sneer. If she thought he was no threat simply because they had him pinned in this room, or because of his injuries from the battle, she was in for a rude surprise, doubly so because they had been sloppy enough to leave the doorway standing open behind her.
Good, you're awake,
she said, her voice low and slightly husky.
I have some questions.
Anubishu gave a contemptuous snort and rose to his full height, ignoring the pain it caused him, so that he would tower over her.
I have no answers for you, he replied.
Sounding unconcerned, if anything, faintly amused, the woman replied,
Oh, don't worry. You will.
She stepped into the cone of light shining down from the lone fixture in the center of the ceiling. cold green eyes assessed Onabishu like a shark considering chum. The light twinkled from the badge on her richly but subtly embroidered black tunic, a stylized silver death's head superimposed on two crossed lightning bolts, above a bar inscribed with what Onabishu assumed was the wearer's surname, Beifong. Regarding the badge, Onabishu realized suddenly that whatever this woman was, she was no police officer. She seemed to sense him coming to that conclusion, and it appeared to give her a certain satisfaction. As she gave him a smile that held neither mirth nor warmth, a thin double scar on her right cheek quirked like a mocking second smile. "You will," she repeated, and the stone door leaped up from the floor and sealed them into the room together. The Order of the Rose will continue.